Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Angus Table. We've got a very special guest at the Angus Table this morning, Mick Crowley from the MLA, Managing Director. Great to have you along.
Well, thanks for having me, Scott. It's great to be here today.
It's a real treat for our members. This podcast goes to a lot of Angus enthusiasts, so they'll be very keen to hear a little bit about your story and your background. I guess to kick off, Mick, tell us a bit about your background, your career, maybe where you grew up.
Scott, I grew up just west of Armidale at Baraba in northern New South Wales. We've got a beef cattle operation there, and my brother moved home to take on the place last year. After I went through high school, I studied rural science at UNE, and while I was there, not only pursuing a career in agriculture, I took on a lot of work around meat judging while I was there, coached the meat judging team for a few years, and that was where I got a lot of connections in the meat industry. I started off with elders when I left university. I was at the Wildbrook branch, and then I transferred into their meat division based up in Toowoomba, and that was really where I got my start in the meat industry. Spent a lot of time in the boning room, in the chillers doing grading, and really cut my teeth in the meat industry. I then worked for Blue Stripe Meats, which was a startup business in Tamworth, and one of your members, Greg Chappell, was one of the founders. It was his brainchild with Toby Scales, Peter Howarth, to get that business off the ground. Unfortunately, we hit some tough times in the business, but it was a really fantastic idea and concept, and something that I think a lot of people have learned from. And that business, that factory we built, owned by Thomas Foods today, they're doing evaluating for Aldi in that factory. But I went and managed a place for a little while, and then I was the marketing coordinator for the Ebal Beef Group. I had my own meat export license and looked after some Korean beef processing over at Casino. Before I joined MLA, that was in 2009, as the Meat Standards Australian Manager. So I did that for a while, and then I was marketing and market access for Europe and Russia with MLA, and then came back to be the General Manager of Research and Development. Stepped out of MLA for a couple of years to run Herefords Australia, so I've had more time working in a breed society, and I really appreciated that, and then was fortunate enough to get the opportunity to be the Managing Director of MLA. So that's a bit of a whirlwind tour of a probably pretty diverse career, but always very focused on the red meat and livestock sector.
Interesting, Mick. That's we've got a bit of common ground there. I spent a bit of time early. My first role was in Singapore in the red meat industry there with Singapore Food Industries, and then interestingly, Chaps was actually the bloke who taught me to how to cook a steak when he was in Blue Stripe Meat. So I didn't realise that was part of your career. So
I got to do a lot of diverse roles there. I was buying livestock, looking after our processing, which we started off at Pittsworth, and then as we're getting export accredited, moved across to Stanbroke, Grantham. We bring the primals back, and we're portioning for food service and retail, doing cooked products, a whole range. And I was running the QA of the factory, and if the cleaner didn't turn up at night, we were hosing down at the end of the night and setting up at the start of the day. And you really get to do everything in a small business like that as you're also trying to grow.
Great way to cut your teeth and learn a lot about the processing sector. And Mick, very similarly, I think we got to know each other when you were the CEO at Hereford. So that was another chapter, I guess, from our side of things in the seed stock world. Great that you've got some experience in the Hereford society there in the stud game. Were you from a seed stock background or a commercial?
Yeah, look, we've got a farm Hereford stud, but it has been going for a long time. I think Our small stud was 1989, and Dad and his brother set up the Thai class stud in, I think it was 1969. So it's been going for a fair while, and it gets in your blood. I love the seed stock game, which is related to half the membership. But it was also a great opportunity to understand the role of you know, the importance of brew societies driving genetic progress. And a lot of the things I was working on in the supply chain at MLA, I was able to apply where you're looking at, you know, how does the impact of genetic selection impact the end consumer outcome? And really trying to get seed stock producers connected with the commercial outcomes and, you know, some of the things that we're working on today in MLA come off the back of that, where I see some big opportunities how we can create, capture more value along the supply chain and really understanding where the pain points are, where the value propositions are to drive more value for our sector. So, you know, we need to start with the right animal, and genetic selection really determines that end outcome. And then we need to make sure we don't stuff it up through the supply chain. And then we really need to get under the hood of what the consumer and customer requirements are into the future. So there's a hell of a lot of work that is impacted, you know, right at the starting point on that genetic selection. So it was a really great experience for me to really reinforce that.
Excellent. The MLA sometimes is a confusing organisation, Mick, in terms of, it's a bit like the government, then people don't sometimes understand exactly what it does and what's its role. And likewise, I guess your role as managing director, in a snapshot, how do you summarise the role of the MLA and your role as managing director?
Yeah, look, and I appreciate we live and breathe it every day, and you take it for granted a bit that we put out a lot of information, but it's really busy to get the cut through. But at its most basic level, we are the service company for the industry, and our core role is marketing and research and development. Every producer will no doubt see that their cattle transaction levy of $5 goes into marketing and R&D. The levy is legislated. The federal government run the collection of the levy, and most of it comes to MLA, but the National Residue Survey, Animal Health Australia, get a portion of the levy. But then it goes into marketing, and it's $3.55 of every levy goes into marketing, 96 cents into R&D. We also get federal government dollars that is calculated, that we get a matching amount of funds that is calculated on the value of the industry that we can use for R&D. So we match the R&D component of the levy dollar for dollar. We can also attract private eligible sources of investment to match with federal government dollars to really scale up our R&D. So then you get under the hood of that. The marketing program covers market access as well, both domestic and international. We've got offices in key markets around the world. We work with industry to support the government-to-government discussions around free trade agreements. Then we also work on unlocking technical barriers to trade. And then our R&D portfolio is incredibly broad, from genetics, on-farm productivity, the feedlot sector, processing, product development, packaging innovation, objective measurement, data and insights, all the market reporting. Incredibly diverse. When I talk about the processing work, that is mostly either adding value to the product and particularly making sure that there is a direct producer benefit. If it's just a process of specific benefit, there's another organisation called the Australian Meat Processor Corporation who do the R&D for the processing sector. We also collaborate with live export. So it's incredibly broad. I understand that it can be confusing from an external point of view, but the core functions are marketing and R&D. And I think the bit that does get confusing is that we are prohibited from doing policy and advocacy work, agri-political activity. So there are peak bodies that are responsible for that, and for the grass-fed production sector, that's Cattle Australia, Grain-Fed Australian Wild Feeders Association. So they're the representative organisations. So yes, it can seem complicated, but we also do a lot of reporting. We have an annual investment plan that operates under our 5-year strategic plan. We publish our annual report every year, and we make sure we consult with industry on a very regular basis. And when I say industry, it's the peak bodies that are the representative organisations that we are consulting with, as well as the federal government through the Department of Agriculture.
That's a really good overview, Mick. It is complex from a producer's side, that sometimes it is hard to work out how the different organisations in our industry work together. From an MLA scale perspective, how many staff roughly, and sort of what's your spread, I guess?
We are well resourced, Scott. We've got 285 staff. Around 50 of those staff are based internationally. Only a small number of expats, about 6 or 7 expats that are based in those markets. They're typically the regional manager. And we have a lot of locally engaged staff in those key markets. And it's, you know, the US, China, Japan, Korea, Dubai, London now. Singapore is a hub for us, looking up to Southeast Asia. But we do have staff in Indonesia and Vietnam, Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand. So they're all of those key international markets. Domestically, we're based, Sydney is head office, Brisbane, Armidale, got a few staff in Perth. So yes, diverse locations, broad skill set required to run a business like that. And our annual budget is around $300 million a year. So we're well resourced with people and funding. And you know, my role as managing director is to absolutely nail that those funds are invested in things that take this industry forward. We do that under a strategic plan and through a very well-designed annual investment plan.
It's a pretty diverse role to keep a hold of, Mick. I guess it's like herding cats at times. You've got a lot of staff, a lot of spread that you've got to keep abreast of. As a leader, how do you do that, Mick? What would you say is your leadership style? How do you keep tabs on such a diverse organisation?
Yeah, one of the early lessons that I had in moving into leadership roles, and you move out of management into leadership, and until you are running bigger teams, you probably don't appreciate the difference. But one of the things I learned very early on was that you can't do it all yourself. And you come from working your way through your career, you build experience. Moving into leadership is not so much about your own success, but the success of those around you. I have quite purposefully made sure I always employ people that are smarter than me, which isn't that hard. But when you do that and you allow them to be successful, that only helps you. And so you have to learn how to scale yourself. So I like to stay across everything because I have to be able to answer such a broad, wide-ranging, you know, topics can cover anything that we invest in. But the capability of the people around you makes you successful. And by setting really clear expectations, very clear ownership, allows you to have accountability of the people around you and let them be successful. So I just try and set the standard. And what the behaviours that I think that I model really set the tone for the culture that you create within a business. Process only solves part of the way you operate. Culture and strategy are really key in the way that I like to sort of, you know, influence the way we run as a business. And then that has a final effect to how we engage externally as well.
Yeah, excellent. You've even got a couple of ex-Angus employees there in your team these days.
Yeah.
Which is great. What do you look for in people, in your managers? What sorts of qualities do you look for in people?
Yeah, it's a small industry, isn't it? So networks become so important. And recruiting is it's a fascinating process in itself. And the way people handle pressure in an interview is one thing. Taking a step back, I also look at eligibility gets someone an interview, suitability gets someone a job. So I'd like to think that we run a pretty robust process on designing those roles and very clear position descriptions, and you're choosing people that on paper get through to that interview stage. The next bit, suitability, becomes really important. You can have very experienced people, will have to be a good fit for the team. So I think that is a really big test for when you're making those decisions. We are in a fortunate position that I think in agriculture generally, we're seeing a lot more really bright, educated people wanting to work in that professional sector, in the service industry. Yeah, we just don't have too many problems getting applications for various roles. And so you're kind of making difficult decisions when you've got such a talented pool of people. So you're kind of lucky in that way, but that also comes off the back of maintaining your reputation as you know, a place where people want to work. So sort of goes hand in hand a bit.
Well, yeah, I can only imagine. In a similar way, we're a smaller organisation, but we have often really good applications from some very intelligent, particularly young people. MLA would be similar to Angus in terms of it's a, you know, one of those employers that we try to be a desired place to work. How do you dig into someone's character? I find this a challenge myself, but that's the under the surface is sometimes hard to.
Yeah, it is, and I think we do a few things. The interview process or we part of it. I like to then go and meet with people one on one as well outside of that environment, just sort of get a feel for who they are. Definitely, and what's becoming more important now is the quality of referees. I think for anyone out there looking for a job in professional services in any capacity, commercially or otherwise, or in service businesses, it's very easy to see through if people are just a little bit on the fence around those references now, that reference check becomes really important. The network, our industry might feel big, but it's actually pretty small, and you'll know someone that they worked with who, you know, can give you some insight as well. It's a challenge. We don't always get it right, but we also make some good decisions, and people who miss out end up in great careers elsewhere as well. But those are good decisions to be able to make when you've got really good talented people around. But you can only, you know, there's only one person you can select in the end.
That's right.
But I also like to maintain those relationships. There are people that might have missed out this time, but they won't be really ready next time. So, you know, I like that, you know, when people are persistent in pursuing a career, you know that they're serious about it as well.
That's true. Yeah, it's a tough role, Mick. It's, I guess you're meeting a lot of people across the whole red meat industry, not just beef, but how do you handle the pressure? I guess at times your role is a very public one. How does Mick handle the pressure of a pretty intense role?
Just with my work hat on to start with, one of the things I find is that whilst not everyone may agree with what we're working on, I try and get to a point where at least there's an understanding of why we're going in a certain direction. Consulting broadly, but also turning up. I'm more than happy to get out in front of people. I find that when we can have a reasonable conversation, really unpack the data and insights that have helped inform where we're heading as a business, but also making sure we're listening and taking on board people's feedback and recognising the context of the operating environment is very diverse. Having a very clear, well thought through and structured strategy that's really practical in its application helps a lot. But it also helps when we continue to be available, present, visible. Those are really core values for me. And I think that most people have the best interests of the industry at heart, and that means that we can have some really robust conversations and find a way forward in most of the time. But yes, there's pressure, there's expectation and judgment. So pressure's easy. I find the judgment hard. Everything's a bit of a test.
Yes.
But I try and carve out time for myself. We're talking offline before the call. Because I'm traveling so much, I always pack the joggers. And I find that time, early in the morning, if I get out for a run, clears the head and sets you up well for the day to be really effective during the day. And it's a great time to... I never run with music, and I just like to think about things. And, you know, I hold myself to a really high standard, so I kind of challenge myself about how I'm going to bring my best every day. How do I come up with the best solution to a problem? How do we make sure we're responsive and we've got that urgency inbuilt to the business, and making sure we're closing the loop on as many things as possible? So, yeah, having that carving out time for yourself is really important.
That's,
but I have to do it early in the morning or it doesn't happen. So
it's a good life lesson, that, isn't it? The important things we have to put first in the day or the first in the week, otherwise we don't get there. We're chatting, one of our staff members here at Angus Australia, I believe, is one of your running mates, which is he's a great young guy that's just joined our team.
Yeah, I give away a few years there, but he's a good runner. Andrew Brennan, we were running together this morning actually, and these young guys keeping the old fellas pretty honest. But we sign up for events. We have a really good social group and good WhatsApp group. And when you say you're turning up, there's a bit of accountability there as well. So, and having something to train for also keeps you pretty honest.
That's great. That's great. Do you have any anchors in life that ground you?
Yeah.
For myself, it's a Christian faith. What about you, Mick? Do you
have... Family's a big one for me, Scott. I've got four kids. My eldest is studying agriculture in UNE, and she's working on a station up in North Queensland at the moment during her summer break. Kids sport on weekends. That's my job. And then I'm a partner in our family business. Pretty hands-off at the moment, but I do try and get back, and there's nothing like, I help mark calves and with weaning, and I still run the stud book and do all the data entry and all that sort of stuff. So it's a good reminder when you're standing crush side and trying to implement the things that the company that I run is encouraging industry to adopt. And my brother's an agronomist by trade, so we often debate about how we need to run our business, and that sort of stuff keeps you very grounded when you're out the back on a horse and just keeping in touch with the practical side of things. But yeah, I think family for me, Scott's a big one. Got a few kids to educate, and
that's great.
Yeah, you got to be present when you're home.
That's for them too. That's great. Family is very, very important, and I think as I reflect on our breed, the Angus breed, it's built on farming families, and it's that is very important. And I share your love of chasing Nord Cow on the weekend to stay grounded. In terms of staying sharp, do you read, Mick? And do you have any books that are a bit of wisdom that maybe some of our members should have a look at?
I keep coming back to running seems to dominate my private life at the moment. Yeah. You know, there's all these memes out there that a runner becomes your identity as well. So I got given a really good book, Ned Brockman. It's called Showing Up.
Oh, yeah.
And so some of those lessons are really fantastic. The book is about he ran from WA to Sydney, and he was raising money for homelessness. He was really touched by homeless situation, and he was aiming to raise $1 million. I think he raised $3 million.
Fantastic.
And he's now become a bit of a during the month of October, he's got Ned's Uncomfortable Challenge, and a few of my mates are doing daily stuff that puts you out of your comfort zone, and he's now become a real ambassador for raising money for homeless people. But you also other people that are quite influential around me. Our guest speaker, we're going to talk about the AGM a bit later, but the guest speaker at our AGM, Brendan Cullen, he's another real inspirational guy. His brother is here in Armidale. Lock Cullen is a real estate agent with Ray White. Those guys are amazing what they do. And so Brendan is the outback swimmer. He was the face of rebel sport. And he's battled through mental health challenges and took on endurance sport as part of his mental health. And he ended up swimming the English Channel solo in 2022. Went back and swimming in a relay in 2023. We then went out to his station that he runs at Broken Hill and ran 100Ks out there in 2024. We were raising money for How's Your Mate program, which is part of a Lifeline program. He's an ambassador for Royal Flying Doctor Service. This year he just completed a Catalina to LA swim. We have to swim that at night.
Amazing.
And there's a bit of wildlife out there in the ocean.
Amazing.
He just completed that recently. So he's speaking at the AGM, and I just love that motivation you get from those guys. And he gets his motivation from his brother, who's based here and good swimmer, good runner, great mate of mine as well. So it's it's a really great lesson of how you surround yourself with people, and also keep you honest, keep you heading in the right direction.
That's great.
Yeah.
On that subject, is there particular senior mentors that you've had through your career that are still...
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people that it's probably people that I've worked with or worked for, through the meat judging program. Jason Strong was so instrumental in influencing so many people. He was the coach of the Australian meat judging team for a long, long time. I ended up taking over from him there. I took over from him in Europe. He was the last MLA managing director, and I worked directly for him for a few years as well before I stepped out. And amazingly, and John Carter, who is an amazing man. He founded the meat judging program. I still keep in close touch with Richard Norton, who was the managing director who gave me the opportunity to join the executive team in MLA. With Greg Chappell and Tony Scales and people like that. So professionally, there's a lot of people. Matt Faulkner, who he and I spent a lot of time doing big hours, big days, working for elders. So there's a lot of people that influence your career. I've been very close to the chairs. That I've worked for two chairs directly now in this role at MLA. The board and some of the people sitting around boards are pretty amazing. And then, yeah, senior private life. I mean, I've then also undertaken a bit more formal formal business coaching. I was talking before about how you bring yourself every day. One of the things in business coaching, the guy that I work with, it's more about him holding me accountable for my own behaviour. So when you think about having difficult conversations, dealing with difficult issues, dealing with staff issues, managing people can be one of the more challenging parts of the role.
Yes.
The only thing you control is yourself. And so moving from, you know, a level of being a subject matter expert into leadership, you have to make that transition as well. And I had to challenge myself on how much ownership I was giving people. Rather than giving them the answers, how was I leading them to the answer? How clear was I on the expectations of their performance, on their behaviour? And so you have to really dig deep, and some of those things are quite confrontational when you have to look at your own style, how you bring yourself and your influence on all of those situations. So personal accountability becomes really fascinating as well.
Yeah, that's
a bit deeper than I thought we'd go to that.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, no, I appreciate that. I think that's some really good insights there, Mick, which is good. Now, in the interest of time, Mick, we could talk for hours here. Just to switch tack a little bit with markets, pretty topical. It's always topical in the beef industry, but I think at the moment there's a fair bit of change going on, and it's a big part of your role to keep abreast of these things. We've seen, you know, quite an interesting year with the tariffs in the US. We're seeing a rising beef and lamb market. It's been very strong. What are you seeing that our producers might like to be aware of? We were talking offline before about the FTA with the UK and more latterly in the Middle East. Yeah, what are you seeing from your position?
It is one of the most dynamic years we've seen. And it has ended up being a positive one in a lot of ways. The impact of the US has always been pretty big. 2024, we saw the US being the largest export market for beef, for lamb, and for goat. I mean, that is just unbelievable in itself. Our domestic market is still our largest and most valuable market. But when the US and the demand for protein in the US is just off the charts. They've got their lowest cattle herd in 70 years. And I've been pressure testing this throughout the course of the last couple of years. Everyone's been expecting the herd to rebuild, and it will. But gee, it's been a lot slower than anyone forecast. And the demand looks like it's going to still be very strong for the next few years. Then you put on top of that what happened in April with the tariffs, and those tariffs were applied to 187 countries. We remain at the lowest level of tariff at 10%, and that's a fortunate position to be in. We thought it was pretty ordinary at the start. In fact, we've got a free trade agreement with the US we've had for over 20 years. But being at the lower level and with the demand, if you look at prices since April, up until very recently, they've only gone up. And we have seen the market come off the ball a little bit at the moment. I think there's a few numbers around. It's pretty warm around the traps. If you've got finished cattle available at the moment, they're being turned off. So we are seeing prices come off the boil a little bit, but the demand outlook is still very strong. Now, off the back of those tariffs, I just happened to be in Japan, China, and Korea the week after the tariffs were announced. And that volatility is still a big challenge for us because we've also seen globally cost of living pressures. Japan, then China, then Korea are the next three largest export markets. China in particular, they took retaliatory measures against the US, and their retaliatory tariffs effectively meant that US beef stopped going to China. They had about 3 months worth of product in storage, but they've come to Australia to fill the gap. So 150,000 tons of US beef stopped going to China. But when we're in Japan and Korea, that product's been quoted into Japan and Korea. So when you have a disruption in one market, that product still has to go somewhere else. So it all moves around. We've also seen significant tariffs on Brazilian product into the US. That's all going into China, Middle East. But so they're the big markets, but they've also been in Indonesia and Vietnam. Southeast Asia is really showing signs of being long-term growth opportunities, improving household incomes. I was very fortunate to have a trip in Middle East, the UK and EU only a couple of weeks ago. The UAE free trade agreement came into force. That's 5% duties go to zero. The UK deal, it's one of the better deals that was done. And it went from, you know, about 3 to 4,000 tons of beef access to 35,000 tons of beef access on day one with no new quota duty. Goes to 110,000 tons after 10 years, then no quota, no duty. We're at about 90% of our beef exports are now covered by free trade agreements or favourable trade agreements. Off the back of the disruption, the EU are also now back at the table discussing a free trade agreement. Those negotiations fell over at the end of 2023, and red meat was one of the reasons that the deal couldn't be completed. So those discussions are happening and are moving pretty quickly now. So, you know, if you start adding those things up and the demand outlook and growth opportunities are very promising. Now, they might be without their hurdles and without their roadblocks. We are still seeing cost of living pressures being very real around the world and people trading down categories, but there's still demand for every category of beef that we produce. What was highlighted to me, one of the reasons of going to the EU was we had the Anuga Trade Fair, which is held in Cologne in Germany. It's one of the largest food fairs in the world. You get 140,000 visitors over the 5 days of the trade show. We had 11 exporters on our stand, and we're really busy. I was surprised how busy it was. I think there's anticipation of better access into the EU down the track, but we're not going to be able to flood that market. But it's a high-value market for us. But then you look at what are all the other countries doing. So there's very strong presence from Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, North America, exhibitors were there, US and Canada. All of the European importers were all in the meat hall. And the demand is there, but every country is focused on sustainability. There was a lot of focus on deforestation and compliance with the EU regulation. It's been delayed another 12 months now, but it's not gonna go away. The other big trend is that everyone is now talking about quality. Now, we've been leading the game on quality. The MSA program leads the world as an eating quality grading system. We have best-in-class animal welfare. Our sustainability credentials are very strong. We should be very proud of the story we have to tell. But you then have to realise, what is it that we need to now invest in that keeps us ahead of the game? How do we continue to differentiate? And so I think that's a really important context for us to think about as an industry, to say, well, how do we get the balance right? How do we continue to optimize productivity within a really difficult and challenging climate, variable climate? We're going to have more droughts, we're going to have more fires, we're going to have more, you know, there's flooding. The challenges are unbelievable. Demand outlook's very strong, but the competitive nature of our markets will only increase. And how do we continue to differentiate to capture premiums, because we're a high cost producer? So I think that's where our approach around value-based marketing will unlock more value. I think we'll see brands, processors and brand owners invest in brand marketing capability, continue to differentiate the brand offering. We'll underpin that with our industry systems and differentiate at a country of origin level. Heaps of brands are still using breed and breed claims, and then it'll be provenance driven. It'll be what is different, and it'll be a combination of environmental credentials, quality credentials, not dropping the ball on food safety or any of the fundamentals, continuing to differentiate on production systems, feeding systems. Breed will still be part of it, but it will be part of the brand story. So and we're one of the few countries that you know, resourced well enough to be able to partner with the industry to continue to drive those investments. So we're in good shape, but we can't get complacent.
Yeah. Okay. To just scratch the surface of China a little bit, it's been a tricky market, hasn't
really
it?
Tricky.
You know, in recent years we had our own access issues to China, and now, of course, they've swung back to Australia as the source going forward. What do you think is the trends and that are going to be evident from that Chinese market? Are we a long-term player there? What do our beef companies need to be looking at to maintain that access going forward?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's going to continue to evolve. It's been tricky. We saw, it was in May last year, we had the beef plants that had been, had suspended access for a long time be relisted, and a really big positive step forward. We've also saw, we only had two sheep processors listed for chilled access into China. There's now 17. And that's off the back of our improving our relationship with China. So it's an important relationship. It's one that will continue to mature, I think. But like any market, I think it also highlights, and with the volatility that we're seeing, because things can change really quickly. I mean, Trump might change his mind on tariffs overnight. Things can evolve very, very quickly. But what that trip highlighted to me through Japan, China and Korea is the importance of relationships and partnerships. So I think if we continue to work with the trade, work with the importers, understand their local requirements, we're very good at meeting customer expectations, meeting their compliance requirements, it sets us apart. So I think those partnerships and reinforcing those partnerships was really important on that trip. There's a bigger political, geopolitical landscape at play that might be out of our control, but what is within our control is how we continue to build those relationships and partnerships. And in the short term, it's a big opportunity for us to work with those customers and hang on to it like hell. I mean, the US will get back in there. We just need to have put ourselves in a very strong position while we can, which we are. So we have to have flexibility in our programs to make sure we're investing appropriately in those markets and resourcing them well. But you know, the M dollar only stretches so far. We had an increase in our levy from $3.50 to $5 in 2005, and we're still operating on that. And that increase of $1.50 all went to marketing, but we're operating now in 2025 on a $2,005 dollar. So we've got to be really smart about how we implement those programs. And we've got some unreal people on the ground. If anyone gets to go to China and wants some contacts on the ground, please reach out, because we've got some real, real talent, very well connected people, and they're really doing some great work.
Excellent. Part of that strategy for Australian beef processing companies was diversity of markets when we had the access issue into China.
Yep.
We've got a lot of, I'm not sure how many markets there are now, but we've got a more diverse footprint, don't we? And what do we do in terms of the ASEAN countries, the smaller markets? And do you see, is there growth there, Mick, over a long period of time? And is the growth at the high end going to continue into those markets like Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, those niche markets? And how do you handle that from an MLA perspective?
It's a balance. We segment the markets on level of maturity, growth opportunities. We often challenge ourselves. We work with the industry of a marketing and market access task force that also has representatives from across the supply chain giving insights. We get a lot of insights on the ground that help inform our strategy. So we adjust the budgets based on where the opportunities are. So we might, in more mature markets, there's a lot of labelling at retail where we have a decent market share. There's bigger customers that can contribute to their own marketing. We partner with brand owners on market development partnerships. We're building this bigger ambassador network within the food service sector as well. We've had the Lambassadors in Australia this week. We have a Beef Mates program. But then we also have, in the maturing markets and the developing markets, more trade-based programs as well, where we're working on helping them understand the fundamentals of our industry systems. We exhibit at trade shows to find partnerships with exporters and the trade. We work with importers with their customers on their knowledge of Australia and their systems. And we recognise that there are opportunities for every quality and every product that we produce. It's really important for it. Like we sell everything that we produce from a carcass, hides, bones, meat and bone meal. We're getting into the nutraceutical space, value-adding offal items and things like that. The growth opportunities come from where there are growing household incomes. So it's not just about population, but household incomes. Then it's about how do you set up a partner with the supply chains that can deliver the product to where the consumers are. And yes, there are big growth opportunities. And I think that will be across all categories of production. I think we have seen perhaps the real premium, uber high quality products under some pressure. But I was in London the other day and we went to Harrods. Now, Harrods isn't, representative of the average consumer. They had Japanese Wagyu in there for £600 a kilo, $1,200 a kilo.
It's an incredible price, isn't it?
The Aussie product was incredibly well represented in there at a significant premium, like massive money. But the people who shop there don't care about price. So there is, I think there is growth at the real top end, and we're doing a much better job of producing a lot more product in those real top end, the highest possible quality segments. And I think we'll end up using objective measurement technology to go beyond the current visual assessment, potentially, particularly in the high end marbling assessment. But I think that also highlighted that there's a significant demand in the next level as well. Quality, there's enough consumers globally at the highest quality level that we will not be able to supply enough of. And we are a drop in the ocean in global consumption. So we can play in the premium end.
It's a pretty exciting time, isn't it, for the beef industry? And all the outlooks look very positive. Our breeders would always wanted me to ask, what are you seeing from an Angus point of view on your travels, Mick, and the penetration of some of those Angus brands? What are you seeing?
There's no doubt that the Angus brand is very well known, from quick service restaurants through to fine dining. What I've noticed is that over time, a number of other countries have jumped off on the back of that brand recognition. And when I think about where things are today, very, very strong position for the Angus breed, very strong growth over the last 20, 30 years. I think that breed will still be an important component of brands, but I'll come back to what I was talking about before is we have to continue to drive our focus on outcome. There's variation in every breed and there is still opportunities to continue to shift the needle on the focus on quality. I think there'll also be a balance in payments in the future around quality, yield, and how well producers nail brand specifications, because brands will create equity in their brands, and the price differential in those brands, even if quality and those yield aspects are similar, there'll be premiums for brands that are getting closer to the consumer, either domestically or internationally. So understanding those specifications, and we're doing a lot of work on objective measurement of quality and yield, building that brand marketing capability, and ideally getting feedback flowing back to the breeder, not just the last owner, and unlocking the value of that data to drive better genetic selection, optimizing production through the supply chain, and absolutely nailing those brand specifications. And I think things will evolve. So breed will get us to a certain point, and then those brands and how they differentiate is where we can unlock more value. So I think as the industry evolves and matures on that branded program, well, we've seen a proliferation of brands. We see a big difference in premiums, even where quality outcomes are very similar. So understanding those opportunities is the next frontier for us. And very difficult to get everything in balance, of course, but we're creating the tools to enable that to happen. But that's where I see the opportunity for multi-breed genetic evaluation. What we've had, and I reflect on my time in the Breed Society as well, is producers are making, and seed stock producers are making, those genetic decisions that are having a huge impact on the commercial outcome. And that's been very much a dedicated, you know, I think about seed stock producers across the country. We see it here in the Angus breed, but across other breeds, it's the seed stock producers quite often are leaders in the industry. They've led and been willing to go out there and really drive performance recording, balancing the phenotypes, and really being moving from traditional ways into using all of the data and technology as well as visual assessment to drive progress. It's been very much a push model. Multibreed is very focused on commercial producers, and I would love to see the multibreed evaluation creating more demand for those sires that are going to shift the needle and it lead to faster rates of genetic gain that drives productivity, improves profitability, and improves the outcome for customers and consumers. That's where I think we can unlock value, but I recognise that has to work with single breed genetic evaluations, and I have little interest in replacing breed societies. What I want to do is make sure we're offering services to commercial producers, and there's big demand, and we've been asked for multi-breed genetics from commercial producers for a long, long time. So we've got the tools and technology and the investments in place that I think we can make it happen. But working with breed societies, working with the commercial sector, as well as processors and brand owners, to understand how we create that pull-through demand, whilst we recognise, you know, you guys do a fantastic job on your breed evaluation and collaborating internationally, that we need to respect as well. So I think we can have a cross-breed, multi-breed genetic evaluation really focused on commercial outcomes in Australia without getting in your way on driving breed progress and making sure you're still working with your international counterparts. So that's the challenge that I'm prepared to take on and work with you on it.
Certainly.
And with your members.
Certainly a challenge. It's a good juncture thanks for raising multi-breed. It's a topical conversation at the moment. You've got a 5-year strategic plan with MLA, and it's one of your pillars, the multi-breed evaluation. Just to ask a couple of questions around that, Mick, we've seen in the north, and we both attended recently at Spyglass Research Centre there, the northern...
The Reconomics program.
It was great, good day, lots of good information there. We've seen that program as long-term and successful with Brahman and Droughtmaster Sanders in the north, good program and other breeds there. In the south, we saw the southern multi-breed disappear. When you look at it, there's that really strong interest in the north, not so much interest in the south, two different governments. What do you think drives the difference there in interest between the northern multi-breed and the southern?
So maybe I'll deal with the southern one first, because New South Wales DFERD have been a very strong collaborator with us over many years. So I think about some of the big strategic partnerships we've done on animal welfare, on livestock productivity, and the genetics investments they've made have been highly significant. The challenge for them is not so much a commitment issue, but a budget availability issue, unfortunately. We were really keen, and are still keen, to drive the Southern Multibreed investment, because that really got the data collection that we need off the ground to be able to evaluate our ability to implement an cross-breed effective multi-trade multi-breed genetic evaluation. And we recognise where we sit today, we need more R&D. So what we always recognised was that we did need a long-term model for reference populations to underpin multi-breed, being able to use genomic technologies. You know, the reference population side of things, as you know, is highly important for improving accuracy of genomics. So we can't always rely on state government investment. So it has brought forward the conversation with the genetics task force about what are the other reference population models to support multi-breed. So I'm expecting we will be able to find solutions, and it might be a range of models that we need to explore. The Reaponomics is a great example of where I think it's where we can look at the benefits from a productivity perspective. When we were at the conference, it became really clear that producers loved the outcomes on adaptation. And those animals that are fertile, that can get in calf at a younger age, at a heavier weight, get back in calf. We found in the breeds involved that you can have it all. You can have highly fertile, still maintaining growth. And the bit that we've done with the breed societies in the north is following those cattle through to getting the carcass data as well. So that is a really neat model. It's been going longer than some of the multi-breed. The state government is partnering with us through the donor company in a similar way that New South Wales do, but were that project still continuing, but we've got till June, so it's been a short window. And what we've also been able to do is do add-on projects, and this is what I want to see more of in our R&D programs, because with the southern multi-breed cattle, we're also able to invest in methane as a trait in the genetic evaluation, cattle being fed at Toolimba feedlot from the southern multi-breed project. We know genomics, pedigree, performance data, and we're collecting methane. So we can, it's an expensive trait to collect information on, but those overload projects make it deficient as well. So we're trying to come up with more of those projects that are, yes, we're solving some, doing some genetics work, but I think we will come up with a model that, working with seedstock producers, commercial partners, and other collaborators to take it forward.
Interesting.
Without its challenges.
But
if it was easy, we probably would have solved it by now, to be honest.
That's right.
And we're prepared to continue to invest. We're finding more of our R&D investments now are attracting private investment. So the genetic space is no different, where our core levy investments go into developing the analytical software and making sure all the R&D can feed into the evaluation. And then a lot of the investments outside of that are through the donor company, where we're using federal government dollars and eligible sources of funding without levies. So that's where we've been able to scale up our genetics investments.
Excellent. Now, members will be keen to hear some of your comments on that. In terms of the big picture for our Angus breeders, what do you see the big issues coming at them in the future? You've got a pretty good helicopter view where you sit, Mick. What would you see as the things we need to identify as a breed and be aware of, or perhaps potential issues going forward that we need to be abreast of?
That's a really interesting one. When I look at all the upside opportunity, it's around the productivity opportunities. We talk about demand and the pull through demand. There's an element of downside risk that we need to protect. So animal welfare gets right to the top, and so does biosecurity. And so you'll notice now in the LPA program that biosecurity plans became a mandatory part of LPA. Animal welfare requirements are now as well. And what it does is it brings very front of mind when you do those plans, but how we use pain relief. How are we looking after livestock through difficult and challenging conditions? And the expectations of the community and customers. So consumers at point of sale is a little bit different to when you're asking people about animal welfare when they're not in the supermarket. That's where we need to make sure we're positioned in our strategy called social capital. What came up a lot in our consultation was social license. Now, when you start talking about social license, the conversation became very defensive and saying, oh, people don't understand what we do. When you start talking about social capital and building social capital, that's when you start going, well, actually, let's get more proactive about telling our story. Let's make sure that we're using pain relief. Let's make sure that we really being positive about how we look after livestock and the land. So those social aspects will become really important. We can build social capital. And through the Red Meat Ambassador program, that's the platform through Australian Good Meat that we're getting livestock producers to tell their story and get in front of some of those issues. So environmental credentials will continue to be something we'll be challenged by. EUDR is a really good one. So EU deforestation regulation was just the requirements being handed to us by customers. So yes, they can be threatening, but also create opportunities if we can, you know, demonstrate our credentials and get recognition for our systems, because all of our businesses are relying on happy, healthy livestock and productive ones. And we have to look after our natural resources or we don't have a business. So we actually have a fantastic story to tell. And if we're not telling it, someone else will fill that space. So it's probably more around that, how we get control of the narrative and how we get back in front of the messaging. Otherwise, the empty space gets filled by someone else.
Mm. No, they're good points. Mick, my board often ask me this question. They'll say, what's keeping you up at night, Scott, as a CEO? What's keeping Mick Crowley up at night in terms of a lot of balls in the air? We've talked about a lot of things this morning.
Yep.
What's front of mind for you that where you go, we've got a few black spots on the road that we need to think about?
Yeah, look, I think I worry about a lot of things. Oh, it's more for me, how do I make sure that, you know, some of the things we were talking about before about not only understanding what we do, but we have so many resources that are available to producers that they may not know about. For me, I challenge myself every day how I'm adding value to a livestock producer's business. There are challenges around certain projects and programs that create pressure. When we come up with solutions, the pressure valve is released. So, yeah, so I really challenge myself to, yeah, thinking about some of those challenges that are out of our control is difficult. And, and they're the things that keep you up. The things that are within your control, I can throw resources at them to solve them. It's some of the intangibles, I guess, Scott. And I know that's not a very specific answer, but it's a reputation of our business, the reputation of our industry. How are we making sure the investments are seen as investments and not a cost? Yeah, there's no shortage of challenges. There's some things that have flow-on effects to our industry. You think about the sheep live export as a good example. That's really out of our control, but also it has a big impact on the viability of our sheep industry in Western Australia. And we need a really strong and vibrant and viable live export industry out of Northern Australia for the cattle job, because that will also have significant impacts to our southern production systems if that's not the case. So you're really trying to get the balance right. We can only do so much, so we have to focus on the things where we can have impact.
Mm. It's a good point, the live export. People don't realise there is a... It waxes and wanes from year to year, but there's quite a trade of Angus heifers out of Australia, live export as well, which has been significant at times, and it's been a great underpinning of some markets that aren't particularly good in drought years. What do you think is ahead with that live cattle export in the north? Mick, it's a hard one to get straight answers out of politicians, isn't it? It's do you think it's well positioned now for the future?
I'm pretty bullish on it actually, Scott, because from my visits to Indonesia and Vietnam, you know, it's still relatively price sensitive. But where the market is today, where it's been over the last couple of years, coming off the back of the highs of 2022. I mean, we all try and put 2023 out of our mind, but where we are, it needs to work for everyone. But the demand for those live cattle into those key markets is really strong, and we need to make sure that we secure those markets for long-term, sustainable livestock demand. And I think we're in good shape. We need to continue to work there. But there's also, I think, other Southeast Asian markets that will emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And market, there's a bit like we're talking about over-indexing on one market on the box trade. We need to have diversity of market options for live export in Australia as well, whilst we also strengthen the relationships of those core customers that will continue to be underpinning that trade fundamentally. So our relationships that are very strong, and I think we're okay, but it will continue to be under scrutiny. But it's matured a hell of a lot over the last 15 years.
Yeah, great. Certainly a worry to still producers in the north. You've only got to attend an NTCA conference to have a sense of that.
Yeah.
But it isn't.
We'll continue to partner. We have a live export program, live export partnership with LifeCool as well. So we do marketing, market access in live export, R&D, live export. and you know, we're talking very closely with NTCR about some programs that we're looking to put in place. So yeah, those are the opportunities, or they're the things that do keep me up at night, but the strength of those programs, we'll keep working on it. So yeah.
excellent. Mick, a question we finish with, or towards the end, we like to ask people on the podcast, what's the best beef eating experience that you've ever had?
How do you narrow it down, Scott? I had the great fortune of being based in the EU for 3 years. I looked after Europe and Russia. Very, very spoiled. Now, Russia at the time was going for the world. It was one of our highest value per kilo markets, under 10,000 tonnes. Air freight, they were buying tenderloin strip line Q-roll by air freight. And I remember going into a pretty flash place over there hosted by an importer, and that was pretty special. And probably the most memorable meal was this carpaccio with duck liver on a cracker that was in a restaurant in Sweden. Again, being hosted by an importer and distributor over there, and I can't remember the name of the restaurant, but that particular dish just stuck in my mind. And I'm pretty sure it was out of a topside.
Fantastic, actually. That's really good. Cool. What do you think's the... I had a lovely Ozo Buco the other day, real treat. What's your most undervalued cut?
I think the oyster blade is underrated. You don't want too much age on it, but an oyster blade, where you take that silver skin off where it sits against the scapular bone and slow cook it, that thick sinew through the middle goes to jelly when it's slow cooked, and that is something to die for. Also pretty good when you seam it out and do a flat iron steak. I love the oyster blade. It's a lot of flavour. It's tender.
I think in the 90s, it would have been about 97, there was a big Australian education push into Southeast Asia, and I remember going to a workshop in Singapore where they were teaching chefs around oyster blade at the time and how to maximise it. It was a pretty cheap cut back in the 90s, and it was a great way to add some value.
Yeah. No, it's good. And yeah, carcass utilisation is such an important thing. That's why diversity of markets is so good. And the chefs and butchers are getting so skilled now, presenting that in a way that consumers are having fantastic experience as well.
That's great. Mick, we've come to the end of our time at the Angus table. Anything you'd like to leave to our Angus members or Angus producers?
Oh, I just really appreciate the opportunity, and more than happy to have follow-up with your members at any point in time. And yeah, look forward to keeping in touch as we work together to tackle some of these big industry challenges.
Thanks, Mick. It was we're thankful that you were able to speak to our members at the World Forum this year. A lot of them know you. You're a great advocate for the red meat industry, so we very much appreciate your time this morning, Mick.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.